a movie came out in the mid-1990s, which some of you will be familiar with. The movie was Titanic. Some of you are pretending you aren't familiar with it, but you are. This movie was the story of Jack and Rose, a lower-class boy who wins a ticket to ride on the maiden voyage of the Titanic and falls in love with the ravishing Rose, an upper-class, high-society girl. Their love is the love that you find in every story of star-crossed lovers down through history. There's an element of fate to it. They were meant to be together, and yet they were meant to be torn apart. So finally, after the love story has concluded and the Titanic portion of the movie has begun, they find themselves in the cold waters of the North Atlantic on a door that, in retrospect, was probably big enough for both of them, but according to the movie maker, was totally not. And Jack and Rose are talking, and Rose is ready to give up the spark of life that has kept her warm. She's ready to just let go. And Jack, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, if you need help visualizing the scene, says this to her. "Listen, Rose, you're going to get out of here. You're going to go on. And you're going to make lots of babies. And you're going to watch them grow old. You're going to die an old, old lady warm in her bed. Not here. Not this night. Promise me you'll survive. That you won't give up no matter what happens. No matter how hopeless it seems. Promise me." She says, "I promise." As she freezes, right? And it's cheesy, and we're tempted to laugh about it, and I'm tempted to make sarcastic comments about it the whole time I'm telling the story, because we all know this story of promise love. It's so cheesy that people went to see this movie over... Some of you went to see this movie in theaters 8 or 9 or 10 times before it came out on VHS. You loved this thing, right? You guys, you loved it. You cried every time. It was just this, like, something about this story was a deeply human love story. It told the truth. And I think the truth, or at least part of the truth that it told, was this. That in our world, and maybe our world is this, a struggle between covenant and chaos. Between promise and chaos. Covenant is just another word for promise. Because when Rose was ready to give up and slip into the icy waters, what did Jack extract from her? A promise to keep going. A promise to survive. If you're familiar with the sweep of the biblical story, you know that over and over again in the biblical narrative, water is representative of chaos. That thing that swallows up all the order that humans have made out of the world. It covers towns and cities in floods. It reduces to nothing the things that are. And I think the chaos that lurked under that door that Rose and Jack were clinging to was simply that. It was the dissolution of everything that made them human. It was the stealing of their love. And over and against the waters of chaos, they had only this, a promise to survive, to keep trying, a covenant, if you will. That's exactly how it goes in the biblical narratives. Think of Genesis 1, this before anything is made, before God makes anything at all, the Spirit of God is hovering over something called the darkness of the deep, the waters of chaos, right? You can think about the Noahic story, when this flood comes in and collapses civilization, covers it over, and reduces it back to nothing again. You can think of Revelation, when the waters come pouring forth out of the mountains and the deep to bring to nothing the things that are. We know it in the biblical narrative. Actually, water represents chaos, even in places that you wouldn't really expect. Think about the evolutionary narrative about how we came to be. Where did we come from as human beings? From the primordial ooze, from the chaos of nothingness, we develop into something. Water represents chaos. And that story of the Titanic really, I think, succinctly encapsulates what it means to be a human being. that it's covenant or promise versus chaos. In fact, we know this in our spiritual lives too. This, we feel this sort of conflict. Who among us has not had the mountaintop experience of the spiritual life where you feel so deeply close, so deeply in love with God? Maybe it was the Christian God about whom you had this experience. Maybe it was some other God. Maybe you've never had an experience like this before. But my suspicion is that many of us have had these sort of mountaintop spiritual experiences. But then ultimately what happens is this. We go back to the chaos of daily life. We go back to the ordinary and to the mundane. And we have no idea how to keep that fire, the fire of the spiritual life, burning. And I think what simultaneously Leonardo DiCaprio and Nehemiah are trying to tell us is this. That promises are on the side of life. That covenant is fundamentally against chaos. That's where Nehemiah and his people are right now. Verse 38, because of the amazing salvation and work of redemption and renewal that they have experienced, that God has given them, they're ready to do something. They're ready to keep the fire alive. And so what do? Verse 38, they make a promise. They make this sort of promise that's going to tend that fire, that's going to keep it from going out, so that they will not forget what it was like to be close to God, to know Him well, to be on fire for Him. And so the question I want to ask today is really this. How can we be like Jack and Rose? Or how can we be like Nehemiah? What sort of promises are love's most powerful weapon to keep our spiritual life alive? What are they? I want to suggest three to you. You see them there in your bulletin, but they're out of order. The first type of promise that we need to make to resist the chaos and keep the spiritual life alive is this. A deeply practical promise. A deeply practical promise. Verses 10 through chapter 10, verses 30 through 30, 32 make this clear. The sorts of things that they vow to do are not pie in the sky abstractions. Okay, they're not generic. I know what you know how this goes in your own spiritual life when you vow to keep the spiritual life alive. Maybe you would say something like this. I promise that I'm going to try and seek God. Sounds great. Sounds super religious, super spiritual, right? I'm going to try to be closer to God. Again, that sounds great. That sounds really spiritual. It sounds really religious. I'm going to work seriously on my spiritual life. Wow, you're ready to be a camp counselor, okay? I'm going to put God first in my life. Great, great. All those statements are great. All of them are true. But none of them, if you'll notice, are very practical. They're so broad, they're so generic, they could mean 10,000 things. What does this commit you to personally in the striving to keep your spiritual fire alive? It's not really anything, right? It's too generic. Notice that also they don't promise that they are going to go on feeling like they did on top of the mountain. They've just had all these feasts and celebrations and everything else. Like, they felt all the stuff, the highest of joys and the lowest of sorrows and confession of sin in the previous two chapters. And what they do not promise is that they're going to go on feeling that zealously for the rest of their lives. No, they give these really practical promises. Verse 30, they make promises about what sort of people they're going to love. What sort of people they're going to love. Verse 31, they make promises about how they're going to spend their time, what they're going to do with their time in the future. And verse 32, they make this practical promise. Here's what we're going to do with our money. All these day-to-day, mundane, ordinary, physical realities that are just the stuff of life for us. You know, it's just how we go through life, spending time, spending money, and loving people, right? Just the basics. We're going to go in more depth over the next 3 weeks into these promises in particular and see what about them makes us separate as the people of God. But for our purposes today, I just want you to notice how eminently practical these promises are. These people recognized that chaos that threatens the spiritual life is most dangerous in the day-to-day. If somebody were to ask you, do you put God first? Everyone would go, of course. But if somebody were to ask you what sort of person you should be romantically involved with, or how much work you should do on Sunday, or whether worship and God's church is that important, well, my sense is that if you're anything like me, you would want to say, mind your own business. Stay away. That's a little intrusive. They've recognized that they've got to get down and dirty with the nitty-gritty. Keeping our spiritual life alive means keeping promises on a day-to-day level. And these folks have done the sort of spiritual archaeology necessary to figure out why they collapsed and lost that flame in the first place. They've been honest about themselves and who they are, and they're ready to take concrete steps to stay closer to God and keep the fire alive. I remember I had a student back when I was a campus minister with RUF, who struggled deeply with certain types of sin and internet activity. It sort of involved all three of these practicalities. And he came to me one day sort of racked with guilt and sadness over this recurring pattern of sin in his life. And he says, Pastor, I've tried everything. And then he said, I've tried God's way to stop this. I thought, huh. I wonder what God's way is. Maybe I should try it. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, I'm telling you, and I've told other staff members about this, and I've prayed really hard, but I keep doing the things. I've tried God's way. And at this point in time, this student was so frustrated and so guilty feeling that he was like, I'm ready to give up because God's way doesn't work. God's way doesn't work. And so I asked him, well, have you told your roommates? Well, no. I said, have you gotten rid of your computer? He says, no, I need it for my job. I said, have you thought about changing jobs? He said, no. And I said, you ain't tried God's way yet. You know, like keeping your spiritual life alive means changing some practical things. I don't know what it is for you. But what I do know is that these promises which protect the spiritual life must be inevitably practical. This strikes us as deeply intrusive as Americans. Mind your own business. You know why it strikes us as intrusive? Because it is intrusive. Because Jesus is so desperate to give you life and love and hope and healing and wholeness and holiness, that he will root out all the things that cause you to disintegrate into chaos. He will. He's set on doing that. You can put a Jesus fish on your car. You can vote for the Jesus candidate. You can practice mindfulness and meditation and burn a bunch of incense. But your spiritual life is on display in the practical promises that you make and keep in day-to-day life. Yikes! Keeping this love for God alive is going to be a lot harder than I thought. Yeah, exactly. That's why you need other people. Point two, that these promises are not just practical, they're public. They do this, verses 28 and 29 show, in this massive assembly. I mean, they're just listing everybody that's there. The rest of the people, priests, Levites, gatekeepers, singers, temple servants, everybody, and then everybody's wife and everybody's son and everybody's daughter, all who have knowledge and understanding, sort of sums it up. And then if that wasn't enough, they join with their brothers, the nobles, to make these promises, to enter into this oath. It's everybody there. They use we. It's not just their private promises to keep life alive. It's everybody's. They're going to make it together as a community because they know that unless everybody hears it and works together on it, ultimately the chaos will overwhelm them. Maybe you remember the story of Odysseus from mythology. Odysseus is traveling back to his wife from the Trojan War, right? He wants to get there, and it's a long journey worthy of an epic in and of itself. He's traveling back to his one true love, but in order to get there, he must pass by the Sirens, these monsters who live on a rock and which will try to lure unsuspecting sailors in with the beauty of their song to crash on the rocks. And so what does Odysseus do? He knows that in order to make it past the rocks, to make it past the sirens, he's going to need his friends. He's going to need them to do something for him. He's going to need them to tie him to the mast of his ship. And he tells them, do not, excuse me, do not untie me. No matter what I say, no matter what I do, no matter how much I beg you or what I promise you, stop your ears, look away from me, and leave me tied to the mast. It's the only way for me to get by. We're going to have to do this together, because Odysseus knows that if he hears the song of the siren, guess what? It'll overwhelm him. He's not strong enough to fight the chaos on his own. Tie me to the mast. Brothers, we're in this together. This is, on the most superficial level, this is why something like church membership is actually so important. You're sort of tying yourself to the mast, right? You're putting yourself in a web of relationships where you say to somebody else, will you take responsibility for keeping me from the sirens? And then maybe you also promise to somebody else that I will keep you from the responsibility or from the temptation of the sirens of life. You're taking responsibility and you're giving responsibility. So that's sort of superficially. We're going to have another church membership class beginning in January for those who are interested. But more deeply than that is this. It's why cultivating deep Christian friendships within the church is so important. I mentioned this earlier. Sometimes we feel like we haven't done anything important if we've just sat around and talked with one another. Where's the Bible study? Where's the content? Where's the thing that we're doing to help change the world? We think of our relationships with one another as secondary concerns of God, and God is concerned with more spiritual things. But I think what this text is really teaching us is this, that the relationships that we have with one another, in close fellowship with one another, are actually a primary aspect of growth in the life of the church and in our own spiritual life and keeping it together. If you're not close with people who love you and love Jesus, who's going to tie you to the mast? Who's going to tie you to the mast? You have to. Otherwise, the chaos will overwhelm you. It's fall, and we start doing fire pits in the fall. Some of you have heard me ask this silly hypothetical. I can't help but doing it because I'm apocalyptically minded. But whenever I'm sitting around a fire pit with a group of people, I sometimes ask this question. I'm always thinking about it. I ask, could this particular group of people keep this particular fire burning if the entire world depended on it? This particular group of people keep this particular fire in this fire pit burning if the entire world depended on it. And it's an interesting hypothetical to me, because what it does is it explores sort of who would keep what role and who would take responsibility for what piece of keeping the fire going. Some of us would have to work to make money to feed the people who were tending the fire. Some of us would have to get really good at lying about what was actually going on in the backyard. Some of us would have to go collect wood from farther and farther away to keep the fire going. And then some of us would just have to watch the other people who are sitting around the fire, because, as Emma has put it multiple times at this point, I would get so scared and worried by the pressure that I would probably just put the fire out on purpose, right? Like, we're going to need each other to do this, you know? What have you learned from the sermon? Don't leave Emma with the fire we need to keep the world aloft, right? We're going to need each other. We're going to need the roles. I'm sorry, babe. You can scream at me about that. But you say it publicly. So we're going to need each other to keep that fire going. It's a silly little hypothetical, but that is basically what we are doing in this room right now, is it not? It's like we're trying to keep our spiritual life, our spiritual fire burning. And like, we're going to need each other for that. We're going to need each other deeply for that. We're going to have to reorder our lives for the sake of one another to keep that fire going. And that, friends, is costly. It costs stuff. It costs our time. It demands change and transformation and sacrifice. It's going to demand something deeper than just practical promises and just public promises. It's also going to demand personal promises. See, the thing we left out, we didn't leave out because it was insignificant. We left out because it's deeply significant and there's just a lot of it there. In Nehemiah chapter 10, verses 1 through 27, everybody in the room writes down their names. They write their names down. And they say, I believe this. I'm going to stand for it. I'm here for it. You think about what that meant in the ancient Near East. Think about what it meant to write down your name on a piece of parchment. That's valuable stuff. It's not like now where there's just printer paper floating around it at Staples. The process of making paper was long and laborious and expensive. Only kings could do it. And yet they thought it was important enough that they should write down 27 verses of people's individual names. Why? Why is that so important? Why is it so important to read that aloud in the assembly of God's people? Think about what it means when you write down your name on a contract or something. It's like you're taking a part of you out and you're putting it out in the world so that like you can't change it anymore. You know, like it's almost like there's a part of you that exists out here in the world and that will exist forever. When you write your name on something, it says, I believe this, I'm standing here, and I may one day need to be reminded that I believe that. It's a tattoo of something that you or some version of yourself that you are prone to forget. When you write your name, your future self is judged by your present self. You're invested when you write your name. You've got skin in the game. This is not just somebody else's promise. This is not just somebody else's program. Now, when your name's out there, it's yours. It's your promise. To keep the spiritual fire alive, you can't just nod along with other people's convictions. At some point, you will be forced to ask the question, is this really me, what I'm saying here? Am I willing to order my life around keeping the love of God alive? Maybe we could ask the question this way. Will I stake myself out? Will I stake myself out? In the late 1860s, the Cheyenne Indians were being driven into chaos and disintegration by the technological might and power of the U.S. cavalry in the American West. And so in an effort to keep the tribe alive and stave off the chaos, Chief Tallbull formed this warrior society known as the Dog Soldiers. Their whole purpose was to keep the tribe alive. They knew that appeasement with the Americans would not work, that they would always want more. And it's that conviction that explains why Tallbull one day found himself in the middle of the night carrying a thick rope over the plains in the dark outside of a U.S. cavalry camp. Around one end of the rope was a stake, a thick stake. And tied to the other end of the rope was Tallbull himself. And when dawn came over the cavalry camp, they were awoken in that camp by the sound of a Cheyenne dog soldier shouting, I am Chief Tallbull, and I stake myself out. He had driven a stake into the ground that he could not move, so that when the cavalry charge came, he would remember what he believed, what he fought for, what his convictions were. And he would stay there, his future self being judged by the convictions of his past self, so that if he lost his nerve, he could remember, this is what I promised, to do everything I could to keep my tribe alive. Would you stake yourself out for the love of God, to keep the spiritual life burning? Would you make this passionate, personal commitment? Would you put your name on it so that it's not just Soren's name or your parents' name or your culture's name, but dang, it's yours. It's yours. Keep our spiritual life alive. We need practical promises. We need public promises, and we need personal promises. How are we going to maintain that kind of conviction How do we make that costly a personal promise? I'll close with this. We do what's called cutting a covenant. The key is embedded in our text. In verse 38, because of all this, it says, make a firm covenant. That's not what the Hebrew says. It's just a way of the translators trying to make it more comprehensible to modern ears. What the Hebrew really says there is, because of all this, we cut a firm covenant. Why would they have said that? Because the practice when you were making these sorts of promises was actually to sacrifice some ritual animals and to spread their two halves on either side and then walk down the middle of those halves so that if they were to break the promise or break the covenant, it was almost like saying, this is what will happen to me. We cut a covenant. And what actually happens in the biblical narrative is this, that what we're willing to say is that God himself is the one who has cut the covenant. That God, as we cut a covenant with him, is saying that I will become like this if this covenant is broken. I will sacrifice myself. It's God saying, I will be with you. Even if it kills me. That is how you make this sort of promise. The promise to keep the love of God alive. By knowing that what you're doing is binding yourself to a love that would rather die than break that covenant with you. A love that in fact did die to keep his word. We can make public, practical, personal promises to keep the fire alive because we know that God would rather die than abandon us. Hasn't he proved that already? Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we long to keep our spiritual lives burning for you. We long to feel close and intimate with you. Would you enable us by the power of your Spirit to keep our word, to become the sort of people who do not forget the salvation which you have offered us, but instead together stand against the chaos and learn to love as you have loved us. We ask this in your Son Jesus' name. Amen.